Well, thank you for finding your way to our new venue. I was as surprised as everybody that here we are, and so it's nice to have this little alternative place to meet. I taught for many years in this room. Some of you go back that far, so I always feel a little bit kind of like homecoming to be in this room. Sorry, I don't have a I don't have sound this morning. Thank you. So I'm just going to have to project. I hope you can all hear me way back in the back. Mick, I'm coming through okay, are you? Good, okay, great. We are in Exodus chapter 15. We just got the children of Israel across the... What we think is this is a map, by the way. This is not a bad picture of a rabbit or whatever else it may look like. Yeah, that's right. So we think the children of Israel kind of made this little trip and then came down here. I was just understanding that now there's a new hypothesis that maybe the crossing point was closer up here. That may be too. This is all in very soft clay, you know, so we don't... want to be too dogmatic about it, but in any event, we have them across the Red Sea, so we're gonna assume it's right about there. This is the Arabian Peninsula. There's a mountain range that kind of comes along here, so that will play a little bit of a role in our studies today. The children of Israel are free from Egypt, really, but not free from Egypt virtually. And that's one of the first lessons we're going to learn about not only the children of Israel and their departure from Egypt, but I think something of our own departure from things we need to leave behind. Because even though the Israelites no longer are facing the threat of chariots, Pharaoh, and all of those kinds of pressures that they were experiencing, nevertheless, we're going to find that they keep remembering Egypt. They keep reflecting on Egypt. Egypt still haunts their imaginations, and certainly there are occasions when it gets a little rough out there and they think about, you know, life wasn't so bad back in Egypt. Really, it wasn't so bad at all. And that good old days kind of mentality begins to settle in. And I don't know about you, I always, when I read those texts, I kind of smile at myself because I see myself so often in that kind of attitude. But as we're going to see this morning, life as a Christian, as a person who belongs to God, is always a journey forward. We're never called to go back. We're always called to go forward, pressing toward the mark. Sometimes we don't feel much like moving forward. We don't incline toward that movement toward a mark, but nevertheless, that's what God is doing with us. And what we have this morning is the first of four kind of crisis moments that the children of Israel are going to face now between where they are here and wherever the Mount Sinai is, which we assume is kind of north of here, up a little further north in the Sinai, or in the Arabian Peninsula. Four crises. Two of them will involve water. The one we have before us this morning is the crisis of bitter water. And it's the entire experience of bitter things in our life of faith and how God responds to that and provides for them in the context of that bitter experience is the crisis that we have this morning. The third of these is also a crisis of water. That's the one where there is no water. And this is that occasion when Moses is commanded to strike the rock. And as he strikes the rock, of course, water flows forth. And that becomes a paradigm in the New Testament for the work of Christ, whom Paul identifies with that rock and says the rock that followed them was Christ, and that as he was struck, water flows forth. And it's a wonderful image, and we'll see that, of course, when we get to it, which will be in a week or two. The crisis in the middle, the second of them, is a crisis of food, what to eat. And so they are fed miraculously. The book of Psalms says, with heaven's food, or the food of angels, you know. We don't know if angels eat, but if they do, this is probably what they eat. And so manna, literally means, what is it? What's it? They didn't know, and that's the name that stuck. So for 40 years, would you pass the what's it there, you know, kind of thing. And so that's kind of fun. And then the last of the crises that they confront is a crisis of conflict. And they are attacked. The first military confrontation that they have in this journey to Mount Sinai, and the first they have, period, as a nation, is against a group that is constantly their perennial enemies, the Amalekites. And they come out, and you may recall, that's the famous scene where Moses is on the mountain, his hands up in the air, looking like a charismatic up there, you know, on the top of the mountain, and the battle is going on down below. And there's wonderful images in all of these, and they're so rich, and there's symbolism in them that you just can't avoid. It's there. It's caused many down through history to virtually view these not only as part of the history of God's people, but having rich allegorical significance. I say that with some degree of reticence. I get nervous anytime people start talking about allegories in the Bible. I think that can get us into some deep weeds that aren't necessarily all that helpful. But in this case, you just can hardly avoid it. And so I'm going to be trying to, with a certain degree of modesty and caution, see some of those so-called types or symbols that show up here, while at the same time granting that these things happened as a matter of the actual historical story as it unfolds. So the first of these we have in this story of the bitter water made sweet. It's Exodus chapter 15 and starting at verse 22. And this is the word of God. Then Moses ordered Israel to set out from the Red Sea, and they went into the wilderness of Shur. They went 3 days in the wilderness and found no water. When they came to Marah, they could not drink the water of Marah because it was bitter. That's why it's called Marah. And the people complained against Moses, saying, "What shall we drink?" He cried out to the Lord, and the Lord showed him, I'm rendering this, a tree. He threw it into the water, and the water became sweet. There the Lord made for them a statute and an ordinance, and there he put them to the test. He said, "If you will listen carefully to the voice of the Lord your God, and do what is right in his sight, and give heed to his commandments, and keep all his statutes, I will not bring upon you any of these diseases that I brought upon the Egyptians. For I am the Lord who heals you." Then they came to Elim, where there were 12 springs of water and 70 palm trees. And they camped there by the water. Isn't that an elegant story, you know? Let's ask God's blessing on our reflection on it. Great God, we are very grateful to you for the opportunity and indeed the deep privilege that it is to gather together, to open the pages of Scripture, to be encouraged by stories that have encouraged your people for 2,000 years and more. And we pray that the lessons that you have here for us would be clear, that we would be faithful to the intended sense of this text, that we would hear your word in it, and that you would strengthen our faith by it. And for all of these, we give you thanks in the name of Christ. Amen. Well, you notice several things here that Christians throughout the ages, going clear back to the second century, as they have pondered these stories, this story in particular, have seen some of these images. Water, a tree, the law. And all of these kind of play together in this interesting kind of counterpoint working your way through this text. So let's take it and try to understand these as they come. Moses ordered Israel to set out from the Red Sea, and they went into the wilderness of Shur. Now I'm suggesting, as we have through weeks past, that the Red Sea is down here, of course, but it has two branches. This is the Suez, and this is the Gulf of Aqaba. And our hypothetical crossing point for the Exodus would be the Gulf of Aqaba here. And there's obviously a lot of controversy about that. It's by no means a subtle question, but it does fit nicely with the text. But now we have them on the east side of that gulf. So they're here in the Arabian Peninsula, not a place noted for its comfort, its appeal, its lovely kind of destination, vacation paradise sort of thing. But it does seem that the people of God wanted to stay. And the Hebrew is actually a little more forceful here than the English. Moses ordered Israel to set out. The Hebrew has the idea of compel them or pull them away, suggesting they didn't want to go anywhere, you know. They were comfortable. They were happy. They've had this great victory. They've seen the Egyptians destroyed in the Red Sea. This seems pretty comfortable, pretty nice. And I think maybe some of them were thinking to themselves, you know, this would do okay as a land flowing with milk and honey. Let's just stay here for a while. And so they stay for a day and 2 days and 5 days and a couple of weeks, and they're starting to put down roots. They're starting to plant a garden here, you know, kind of set up the little tent there, and things are getting fairly comfortable for them. And Moses finally has to compel them to be on their journey. And this is very much like us, of course. We do have a tendency when we find a comfortable place to want to stay there, to want to enjoy it, not have anything change. I don't know about you, I'm getting old. And what I'm finding is that the older I get, the less I like things to change. I used to be real frustrated as a young person with all of these old folks who never want to change anything. You know how it is with youth? Now I'm not youth anymore. Now I like my schedule. I love my schedule. I don't want it to get messed up. I like the routine. I don't want to change. I don't want to move the furniture. I don't want to do anything. And it's, you know. My wife is much younger than I am, by the way, I might mention. And I think that's a little bit the way we are in our faith life as well. We find a nice, comfortable place, and we just want to stay put. And we forget that the life of faith is a journey. John Bunyan wrote about Pilgrim's Progress, you know. Pilgrim's Progress. There's a journey. And we're not there yet. And God has lessons for us. We need to view our life of faith as kind of high adventure, in which we're on this road to somewhere wonderful, and nevertheless we have to fight dragons along the way. And sometimes those dragons are not very welcome. They're not very enjoyable. Well, I think the people of God are feeling that. And so the Hebrew here kind of subtly at least suggests to us, Moses had to get out the whip. Okay, everybody, enough of this. You know, time to get on the road. And so he ordered them to set out from the Red Sea, leaving this great place of victory and glory behind, and going off into the unknown. And they went into the wilderness of Shur. The word Shur means a wall. And it seems that it's suggesting probably the topography of what was going on. They probably crossed here, they're heading north, and there is kind of a wall of mountains on the east, and you've got water on the west. So it was probably a kind of path that was somewhat constrained as they begin to head north and head toward that mountain where Moses had originally confronted God at the burning bush. And so away they go. They went 3 days in the wilderness and found no water. There's not a lot of water there. The wilderness is not known for its water, but also we notice that these people don't seem to be complaining yet. They're probably carrying some water with them, but water's heavy, not real portable. They've got livestock, and they've got some logistical challenges as they're traveling along with this portable water that they have. And of course, soon enough, it's going to run out. But so far, we don't have any intimation that they're whining or complaining or anything like that. It seems like they're willing to accept, you know, this new reality, and off they go. But then they see off in the distance this apparent oasis. And notice how it reads. They came to Marah, and they could not drink the water of Marah because it was bitter. That's why it's called Marah. Do you think it's trying to get a point over to us, you know? Anytime, especially in Hebrew, that you have this repetition of a word in rapid succession, sometimes it'll be very rapid, holy, 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 that kind of thing. in Jeremiah, we hear of the people of God and their idolatrous state of mind going into the temple and saying, "This is the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord," as if by emphasizing so much the temple of the Lord, they could justify their idolatrous anti-temple practices, you know, a kind of superstitious confidence in the temple of the Lord reflected in that threefold repetition there. Well, things like that happen in a text like this as well. We're supposed to hear that the great emphasis, the great significance, and really the deep kind of insight to the whole text is found in that word mara. It's a rare word. There's only one other Old Testament story that I could find anyway that uses this word. Does anybody know what it is? You might know off the top of your head. Where do we find this word mara also used in the Old Testament? Anybody know? Ruth is exactly right. Very good. The book of Ruth. And of course, if you know the story of Ruth, you know Naomi is this Jewish lady. Naomi has a word, is a word that kind of suggests a state of blessedness and so on. But hard times hit Israel, and she sees, along with her family, greener pastures down in Moab. And so off they go with husband Elimelech, two sons, and settle in Moab. And for a while things are fine, and then you know what happens. She loses her husband, she loses her two sons, and all she's left with are two daughters-in-law, and she assumes they're going to stay put. Ruth, of course, heroically, "Your God shall be my God, your people my God, I'm not going to leave you, ask me not to do this," so on. And Ruth hangs in there, but they come back to Bethlehem, and everybody's excited because she's been gone for so many years. And they said, "Do you know, no, Naomi's back." And what does she say? "Don't call me Naomi, call me Mara, you know, because life has become bitter for her. There's been bitter disappointment." She doesn't know that all of that bitter disappointment was intended in God's providence to put her in one of the most wonderfully strategic positions in the Old Testament, because, of course, Ruth becomes what? Like the great-great-great-grandmother of King David, and becomes one of the few Gentiles in the whole lineage of Christ. All because Naomi experienced bitterness. And so I think part of the lesson here is that there's bitterness that comes, but it will be a precursor to God's rich blessing. So if you are in a bitter place, which some of you are, we all are occasionally in bitter places. We drink the water, it doesn't taste so good. And the lesson we should learn from this is that that's part of God's design to prepare us for something good. So embrace it, as unpleasant as it may seem at the time. Here, they couldn't drink the water. And I think at least what we're supposed to see in this is some idea of disappointment. The people had gone for 3 days without water. There was a sense of expectancy. It's one of these days, soon, hopefully, we're going to come across this which we've been lacking. And then there it is, you know. And they see that, and they sort of pin their hopes on it. There it is, water, it'll be so delicious. And then the word ripples through the crowd, "It's bitter, you can't drink it." Disappointment tends to be more acute, of course, when it's tied to elevated expectations. The higher the expectations, the deeper the disappointment. Buddhism teaches that there's pain in this world, and the pain is always a result of desire. The Buddhist solution: get rid of the desire, you get rid of the pain, you know. And Buddha gives us the Eightfold Path. Follow this path, and you will eliminate, by a kind of discipline of the mind, desire. And once you have rid yourself of desire, then the prospect of suffering is greatly diminished. That makes good Buddhism. It doesn't make good Christianity. It doesn't make good biblical faith. We're never told, biblically, to my knowledge, to just eliminate your desire. We are people wired to want, right? And if you're normal, you want something. I mean, people to their dying day want something. They want. And God has placed within us this strange kind of psychology, whatever it is, that just attracts us to things we want. And it's really a denial, I think, of our fundamental humanity to try to eliminate, try to, you know, do some kind of frontal lobotomy, get rid of that so we don't have this desire anymore. But the lesson we're supposed to learn is that this that we desire, at the heart of the matter, is nothing other than God. We were made for Him. And the deepest satisfaction we can find is a satisfaction in Him. Which I have to say to you, I'm beginning to believe that now that I'm 61. I didn't believe it so much when I was 31. But you begin to realize with experience that every neat little, you know, I'm a gadget guy. Some of you can identify with that, some of you cannot. But if you ask me what I want, 9 times out of 10, it's going to be a gadget. I love gadgets. I love them. If they have little bells and whistles, all the better. And if they're in bright colors, I'm just happy, you know? And how many times in my life have I bought a gadget? I don't even want to go into it. The pile of cash that would be up at the front of the room if it were all the cash I've spent on gadgets. And, you know, to this day, I have to say to you, I still flip through catalogs and think, oh, if only I had that. You know? And what is this? What is this kind of strange thing in us that there's just one more thing around the corner, over the horizon, just one more purchase, one more gadget, one more this, one more that. And it can take 1,000 different shapes, 1,000 different forms, can't it? And yet somehow there is this disappointment when you get it. Now, not that I don't like my gadgets, don't get me wrong, but I mean, I've got this great one right here. I love this thing. I love this thing. It's just iPod. Oh. But you know, even that hasn't brought me soul satisfaction. Even my iPod leaves me with a sense of something else in life, you know. And the bitter waters here, I think, stand for all of that. They stand in some sense for the fact that there's a kind of illusion, there's a sort of mirage in life that always is drawing us forward to the next oasis, the next gadget, the next this, the next that. And it's not bad. It's not that these are evil. They can be. They can be idolatrous. But in some ways, part of the lesson that should be dawning on us is that there's something that does satisfy. As Augustine said, we have this God-shaped vacuum. We were designed finally for intimate fellowship with Him. And in some ways, every stop along the way, every new thing we realize is supposed to teach us more profoundly that ultimately there is only one great satisfying experience. Corrie ten Boom said, "You'll never know that Christ is all you need until Christ is all you have." And of course, she had some experience with that, going through the Nazi experience there in Germany and being stripped down to the point that pretty much it was true. Christ was all she had. And she's been a wonderful advocate ever since that really Christ is all we need. That doesn't mean we should therefore try to eliminate our interest in gadgets or things like that, but it needs to kind of moderate that and help us understand that at the heart of the matter, there's something else going on. And that there's a deeper, more satisfying and fulfilling prospect, something to be desired that transcends all of these. Well, anyway, they thought the water was going to make them happy, and it disappointed them. It turned out to be Marah. And the people complained against Moses, saying, "What shall we drink?" He cried out to the Lord, and the Lord showed him. And now it reads here in the NRSV, "a piece of wood." I was astonished when I read that. I've never seen it translated that way before. It's always rendered a tree, you know. And I checked with the commentators, and they all agree it's a tree. So I don't know. I can't account for this. I don't know. It may be an alternate meaning, but it sure seems to miss the point to me. I notice in the margin, even in the NRSV, they say, or a tree. So there you are. But anyway, I'm just going to take that. That's been the traditional view. That certainly is seems to be squarely the sense of the Hebrew here. And so it is a tree. It's not expected. There's turns and twists in this story all the way through that sort of leave us a little bit, you know, wondering, well, what's the meaning of this? A tree. I would have thought that the story would have said, and God said to Moses, stretch out your staff over the bitter waters and they will become sweet, or something like that, you know, some sort of consistent expression of the miracle-working power that God had already given Moses. But here we have the introduction of a somewhat unexpected image, which virtually has been taken almost universally down through church history as a great symbol. Not to deny the historical, you know, circumstance as it happened, but why a tree? There are in parts of the world trees, as I understand it, that have the effect of giving sweetness to, you know, bitter things, bitter water and so on. It's something in the leaves and it kind of rubs off and does that. No tree like that has ever been known to grow in Saudi Arabia. So I think we can rule that out. It's not just some kind of natural growing foliage here that was able to sweeten up the water. Something else is going on. And of course, if we think about the tree, then I think we get close to the significance of it. The tree, biblically, has rich significance. The whole story of the human drama starts, of course, with a tree, doesn't it? Children of Israel in the Garden of Eden, they can do anything they want. They can eat of all the trees, except one, which is the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. You all know the story very well. There's another tree hiding in that story, somewhat mysterious, not much said about it, but it's the tree of life. But the tree of the knowledge of good and evil more or less occupies our attention. Adam and Eve succumb to the desire, and they eat, and that tree becomes a tree of bitterness. It's a bitter tree. And injected into the human experience is the bitter poison of being fractured in our relationship with God. Yeah, it was the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. We experienced evil. Now we know something about it firsthand, up close, personal. But we find out that that experience is one of bitterness. And the tree then takes on a kind of bitter quality. But then there's another tree, only alluded to, mentioned in passing in the Garden of Eden, that becomes a tree at the end of the story. So in a sense, the story of the human race is the story of two trees. This first tree in the Garden of Eden, and another tree in the last three or four chapters of Revelation, you recall, is a tree that's growing there in the middle of a city that has a river running through it. And what we hear is that on either side of the river is a tree, which is very hard to imagine. I always think of driving through the redwood forest, you know, and you kind of drive this big tree. I don't know if that's what we're supposed to envision, but it says one tree growing on either side of the river. So, you know, however you want to envision that. The tree bears its fruit. 12 fruits are born throughout the year. 12 kinds of fruits for 12 seasons of the year. And it's a constant source of sweetness and gives life. And so we have these two trees. And then sprinkle through the biblical history, you find trees showing up in strange, unexpected ways. Moses says in the book of Deuteronomy, cursed is everyone who hangs on a tree, you know. Absalom dies when his hair gets caught in a tree. Remember that ridiculous sight of him hanging there by his long, wonderful hair. But of course, the whole story kind of comes together, culminates, and Paul himself puts this together with Moses' statement that Christ died on a tree. He died on a cross, which is, as it were, a tree. And that, Paul says in Galatians, in that way we see that he became a curse. There's a bitterness in that tree. There's a bitter tree, you know. that in a sense plays out richly the whole significance of a tree that became the source of bitterness. It's the ultimate expression of that, but it opens the door for the tree being a very different kind of image, which we see finally in Revelation, the tree of life. Well, here we have this tree now that shows up, you know, in the story. And Moses is told to take the tree and throw it into the midst of the bitterness. A symbol, as it were, of bitterness thrown into the midst of the bitterness makes it sweet. You know. And I tell you, from the very earliest Christian comment on this text, it has been almost without exception taken to refer to this notion that our lives in and of themselves are bitter. People live bitter lives. They try to take pills for it. They try to take drink for it. They try to have parties for it. They try to do all kinds of things to mollify the bitterness. But you don't have to dig very deep. You have people in your life, people that don't have faith, people that just you have dealings with. You don't have to scratch very deep in the lives of most people to find bitterness, you know. That's why so many of us are so superficial in our conversations. How you doing? We don't want to know. You know? Whatever you do, don't answer that question. Just, we have this kind of superficiality in our conversations because we know that if you actually stop and look in someone's eyes and say to them with some degree of sincerity, how are you doing? You better have 3 hours. Because that's what it may take for them to tell you how they're doing. There's bitterness. And how do we solve that? What do we do about that? Well, we have all kinds of solutions, gadgets. We have a media machine that's just cranking out constantly all sorts of products that will relieve you of your bitterness and give you happiness. Do we see this all the time? What's the real solution to it? I think the text is inviting us to see, as Christian history is taken this story to mean, that you have to throw that symbol of bitterness, the tree, Christ, on that bitter, cursed tree into the middle of your bitterness, and strangely enough, in a miraculous way, it becomes sweet. You know, we thought happiness would come through some self-help psychology. We thought it would come through just cheering up a little bit. We thought it would come through all kinds of things. It's a strange, unexpected twist to learn that the bitterest event in all of human history, that brutal execution of Christ on a bitter tree, would become the source of the deepest sweetness of life. That's the way the church has seen this story, and I'm sticking to it. You know, I think that's what's going on here. I don't know that the people of Israel there at the side of I don't know that they knew that. I kind of doubt that it dawned on any of them, the rich significance. But we can see now through the eyes of faith, looking back on this, how the deep meaning was gotten over to us. So he throws this piece of wood, this tree, into the water, and the water became sweet. Now, unexpectedly, we have a paragraph that seems not, almost as if it doesn't fit. But notice what is stated. There the Lord made for them a statute and an ordinance, and there he put them to the test. He said, if you will listen carefully to the voice of the Lord your God, and do what is right in his sight, and give heed to his commandments, and keep all his statutes, I will not bring upon you any of the diseases that I brought upon the Egyptians, for I am the Lord who heals you. And we think, whoa, what is this? This is now all about law. It's about statutes. It's about ordinances. And what we're going to see, this is the first of several little details in these stories, which tells us that the story is intended to prepare these people for Sinai. At Sinai, they're going to receive God's law. Moses will receive it, bring it down from the mountain. You know the story, we'll get there soon enough. And this is the time when God provides for his people that legal infrastructure, that moral code, the civil law
that is going to organize and guide and sort of shepherd them down through history until Christ. And we are very deeply grateful for that law. And in some ways, this is the first intimation of what it will do. There's benefits that come by being a law-abiding person. You know, it's hazardous to your health to be non-law-abiding. It's good for you to be law-abiding. Puritans, one Puritan in particular, I think it was John Owen, used the image of a fish. A fish is designed to swim in the water, just as we are designed to swim in the law of God. When a fish says to himself one day, you know, I've had it with this water. This is very restricting to my sense of freedom. I'm going to jump out of this water and see the world. And the fish can flop out onto the shore, and for one moment the fish is free, and then the fish is dead. You know. And we can do that. We swim in the law of God. That's where we're supposed to be. That's what's good for us. It's the air we breathe. It's the thoughts we think. And if we decide we're going to flop out there on the shore and be free from God's law, we can do it for a moment, and then we're dead. The wages of sin is death. It is hard on your health. And so the law of God comes to free us from those diseases. Egypt had diseases. They had one of the most sophisticated medical professions known in the ancient world, but part of the reason is because they had so many diseases, you know. The whole entire ancient Near Eastern world had all kinds of diseases and plagues that troubled them. A notable exception were the Jewish people, because as they obeyed God's law, it freed them from so much of those disease processes. Sometimes we read it with modern eyes and we look at those, all those restrictions, the clean and the unclean, and all of these kind of pedantic sort of regulations, and it looks like a bunch of cultic taboos out there. We think, what is this? But the fact of the matter is, the people who really lived by those, the dietary regulations, the hygienic restrictions and so on, it exempted them from all kinds of diseases that were rampant, really, in the surrounding world. And I think we know that. I think we know as moderns. You know, you ask any doctor, we've got a couple in the room here, you know, about the diseases we experience and how many of them are self-inflicted. How much of the bad health experiences we have are the result of our own lousy choices? Isn't it true? Not all of them, obviously, but isn't there a correlation there? And that as we swim in the sea of God's law, as we do what he's called us to do, we are freed from these diseases. But, and this is a little kind of twist in the story that I think is implied here, not stated in so many words. Obedience to God's law will bring a general condition of blessedness in your life, but it will not ultimately free you from the deepest bitterness of your human experience. You will be better off by living by the Ten Commandments, but it will not free you ultimately from the deepest and most bitter aspect of life, that deep brokenness that requires the work of Christ. And so in spite of the general benefits of keeping God's law, which is suggested here, we still have to keep in mind that there is this image of a tree that's cast into the bitter waters. That's what makes them sweet. That's why religions that are simply built around obedience to a rule will produce people who may be a little bit better off than the rest, but there's still a kind of emptiness to it. You see, it still doesn't finally satisfy. There's something to be said for being a law-abiding person. It's a good thing, but ultimately there's something deeper that has to cure the ill in our hearts. And so we have this kind of twofold story all mixed together here. We've got the tree thrown into bitter waters, and we've got the law, which gives us a wonderful sense of general blessing, exemption from many diseases, but we still need that tree. Both of those are held together in this story. Finally brings us then to verse 27, the last verse. Then they came to Elim, where there were 12 springs of water and 70 palm trees, and they camped there by the water. We think about water and how important it is throughout the biblical narrative, how important it is in this text. We think about how water describes life. Jesus speaks to the woman at the well about living water. Whoever drinks of this water will thirst again, but I give water that will be a well of water within you, springing up to everlasting life. And that, in a sense, is, I think, pictured for us here, the gift of water. So they come to Elim, and there's 12 springs of water and 70 trees. And again, classical Christian understanding of this has, and Jewish for that matter as well, has seen this as both symbolic while at the same time being historical. The 12 wells of water, of course, there's 12 tribes of Israel. There were 12 apostles of the land. The number 12, of course, is very significant throughout the scriptures and stands, in a sense, for completeness. It stands for the idea that there is a provision that is adequate. 12 wells of water for all the 12 tribes of Israel, that everybody has plenty. And there's a kind of sense of sort of a rich fulfillment of all our expectations there. The 70 palm trees, of course, 70 is another big number. We have the 70 elders of Israel in the Old Testament. We hear about them soon enough. And that stands ultimately for what's called the Sanhedrin later. But it stands for the leadership of the people of God. It stands for a place of rule and confidence. And the fact that there are 70 trees. The trees now, in some sense, representing that place in which godly leadership is being provided for them. Palm trees tend to suggest the Garden of Eden. When Solomon built his temple, he carved palm trees, you know, on the walls and so on. So there's something Edenic about this. In a sense, they've just come through a bitter experience, and now they come to a place where they're richly provided for, where, in a sense, the trees become not trees of curse, but trees of blessing. The water is rich and provides for them. And it says something about the rhythm, you know, of our Christian journey. So that's the first of the crises. We have this one of bitter water. Each one, it seems to me, the manna next week, the rock the week after that, the battle with the Amalekites after that, each one is kind of preparing these people for Sinai. And I think each one is giving us a little insight into how we should view our life of faith. Father, we are grateful to you for this wonderful story of your provision. And we have to admit that all of us have been there. We've all been at that place where we drank water, found it bitter, and felt that disappointment. But we've also been the beneficiaries of the rich grace that comes as you show yourself to be all that we really need. We pray that as we continue to review these stories, that you would drive home to us ever more deeply that great truth. We give you thanks for these things in the name of Christ. Amen.